So my name's David. I'm one of the elders here at Grace Church. Steve is our other elder. I did expect some people to be taking it easy this week, although it's a good crowd out, so well done. I bet some people, having worked so hard this week and are in Patchester week, are going to be taking the opportunity to have a Sunday lion. But that's not you, so that's good. And I wanted you to know that it's not Steve either. You know, when you got here and you said, well, Steve Petch isn't here, I thought you might think, you know, maybe he's taking it easy this morning. He's not taking it easy. He's preaching at our commission church in Billingshurst. And I'm sure they're having a great time up there. But can I just say a big, big thank you to everybody, anybody who was any way involved in our Impact Chichester Week. It's just been so good to work together. You know, that sense of really joining together on mission. And I just feel that we have really blessed Chichester this week. And it's good to hear those stats from Joe, what we've done. But, you know, there's something intangible as well, isn't there, about what we have given the city this week. And I'm sure, I know, I'm in faith that we will bear fruit from that over the weeks and months to come. If you are here this morning because you got a leaflet through your door or you met somebody from Grace Church this week, can I just say a special welcome to you? And it's so good to have you with us. Do let us know who you are. Do stick around for a cup of tea afterwards. And we just want to welcome you and make you feel at home. Why not come back next week? Why not make this your church? We have all done that at some point. So can I just say how good it is to have you with us? Right. Let's get on with it, shall we? Let's read John chapter 8 together and then we'll get stuck into this passage. Starting from verse 2. Early in the morning, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, that's Jesus, and he sat down and taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery. And placing her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. So what do you say?" This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and he wrote with his finger on the ground. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and he said to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." And once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones, and Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more." So we are in the middle of a preaching series. And in fact, last week is the end of the series, so we're nearly done. It's called Grace Works. And I guess there are two aims as we go through this series. The overarching aim is that we might understand that we are recipients of God's grace, and therefore we have a mandate to demonstrate that same grace to the world around us. But then there is a kind of second objective as we go through this series, and that is that from a place of faith and understanding that we might hear the call of God and actually respond ourselves. You might see a need and you might think, do you know what, I can do something about that. I'd like to get involved with that. Over the last year, just to tell you, I've just had increasingly on my heart that we could do something in the whole area of supporting victims of domestic abuse. And that's something I feel God has been speaking to me about. And so I've been talking to our commission churches down in the Bournemouth Poole area, who are already have a very active ministry in that area. And I'm also beginning to talk to people locally in the Chichester area as well. Can I just say, if that's something that God has put on your heart as well, or you've been thinking about that, please do come and chat to me about it. I would love to know who you are. Okay, so that's just something that I feel God's been speaking to me about. We'll see what happens over the weeks and months to come. Through this preaching series, we've posed a question each week. So far, we've had, shouldn't we just be concentrating on evangelism? And then when we looked at the mercy of God, we asked the question, well, why should we help people who don't deserve it? Last week we had, why should I bother to do anything? Surely I can't make a difference. It was good to have people from Compassion here last week, wasn't it? And just to say also, if you were still thinking that you would like to sponsor a child in the Philippines through Compassion, then Claire, who was with us last week from Compassion, she left a small number of child profiles with us, so, and they're actually at the info desk. So if you wanted to sponsor a child, you can do that this morning, but you have to be quick. Go to the info desk. We'll sort that. This week, as we consider this account in John's Gospel of Jesus and the woman who was caught in adultery, the question I would like to pose is this one. Can I help someone who is in sin? And we need to define what that means. Can I help someone who is in sin without at the same time condoning that sin? You see, when any of us in our lives, if we're not in obedience to God and living out a worship to God, but rather following our own ends and our selfish impulses, then the result of that is sin. And Galatians 5 describes what results as acts of the sinful nature. And it says they are obvious, they're easy to spot. And then it lists a selection: sexual immorality, impurity, debauchery, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, discord. And so it goes on. And when you're a Christian, and the Holy Spirit is living in you and begins to transform you from the inside out, it's not surprising that acts of the sinful nature start to not sit well with you anymore. That's exactly how it should be. We are told to throw off the sinful nature and put on our new nature, our new identity, which is in Christ, and go and live a life of purity, which incidentally we are now fully equipped to do. That's life as a Christian. But it's not long then, living that way, before there are whole areas of life, whole sections of society that maybe we would rather not associate with at all. Whole issues we would rather not consider. When I was in Winchester several years ago now, but in the church I was leading there, I went as part of a team into Winchester Prison. And at that time, one of the wings of the prison was classified as an isolation wing for serious sex offenders. And we would conduct a simple church service and have tea with those prisoners and just be friendly with them. But on a number of occasions, when I was trying to recruit people for that team, I found that people were up for it right up until the moment that they found out the nature of the crimes that those people had committed. And then they said, well, yeah, actually, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I feel comfortable with that anymore. I have the greatest of respect for Heather Miller, who is Guy Miller's wife, down in Boscombe, near Bournemouth. And she heads up a ministry that works into Bournemouth's red light district, befriending and meeting the needs of prostitutes, many of whom are in desperate life situations. And I think many of us would rather duck our heads down and pretend that the whole issue doesn't exist, that it makes us feel uncomfortable. And maybe at the back of our minds is the thought, well, what they really need to do is make better decisions in life. They need to stop sinning. And then maybe God would bless them. And if they're living out the consequences of their sin, then they probably deserved it. Now, they're just two examples, the Winchester prison, the thing in Bournemouth. Those things might not be an issue for you. It may be that other things are an issue for you. Just areas that just kind of make us feel uncomfortable. We just think, you know, I'd rather not go there. Many people in our society are in need of help. People you meet every day. And sometimes that need is, at least in some ways, because of bad lifestyle choices or perhaps even because of sin. Now, clearly, that is not always the case. And we need to be really clear on that, don't we? Not everyone who is in need is there because of sin. Stuff just happens in life, doesn't it? But it certainly was the case for this woman who encountered Jesus. And from time to time, you will encounter people, similar people in similar situations, and God will put them on your heart. People who are in need, but they're in a situation and you think that makes me feel a bit uneasy. Each week in this preaching series, we've taken the opportunity to highlight a ministry that is already up and running in Chichester and doing excellent work here. This week, I want you to hear about the work of Options. Options is a crisis pregnancy counselling service, and it serves women and men in need throughout Chichester District, throughout the Bognor Regis area as well. Now, my wife, Ali, is going to come and tell you about that in a moment. She leads this work, and I want you to hear from her. I want you to hear her motivation behind it. Because they are working every week with issues of pregnancy crisis, issues of pregnancy loss, and it is inevitable that they are never very far away from the issue of abortion. Now, that is an emotive subject, and for many people, that is a very sensitive subject. Perhaps for many of us, it's a subject we would just rather leave alone and not think about. The truth is, there are many people throughout our communities who are in desperate need over these issues. And Options actually do a fantastic work showing people that there is forgiveness, that there is restoration, that there is hope, that that God has a wonderful plan that he's fulfilling for their lives. But I'll let Ali tell you all about that. With all these situations where we are faced with need, but as a Christian, we just maybe feel uneasy and uncomfortable, we need to learn from Jesus. We need to see what Jesus did. And in fact, he did three things that he still does today. The first is this: Jesus looks beyond the sin and he sees the person. Do you know what? There is value in human life. You are valuable to God. And it is entirely independent of social class, of particular circumstances in your life, or indeed anything you have or haven't done. That's how God sees you. And do you know what? That's how we must see people in the world around us. God is our creator. It says in Genesis chapter 1, this is God speaking. Let us make man. I'm losing my voice. That's the result of Impact Chichester. Let us make man in our image, in our likeness. And let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Do you know human beings are unique in the whole of creation because we alone are made in God's image? We are God-like beings. You can look at any person and there is something of the reality of God in them. And it's reflected back to God in worship. We reflect God's nature and thereby bring him glory. And we also demonstrate God's nature to the world around us. There is nothing else in the world, living or dead, that God has chosen to bear his image. There was a statue that was discovered recently. I'll show you a little picture of it. It's a statue of a king, and it's a king from the Assyrian Empire. It's very, very old. It's like 8th or 9th century BC. And on this statue that they recently discovered, there's an inscription, and the inscription is in Aramaic, which is very similar to the biblical language of Hebrew. And the inscription says, this statue is the image and likeness of this king, who was called Hadadisi, and he was the governor of Gosan. And it's just that expression, image and likeness of, is exactly the same expression that's used in Genesis 1, where God says, let us make man in our image and our likeness. There are no statues of God, but God has chosen you to bear his image. So what does that mean? Why is being made in the image of God significant? Well, firstly, it means that we are dependent on God for meaning in order to explain ourselves. For all the advances of medical science, you'll never be able to know what it is to be human by dissecting a human body or by decoding the human genetic code. You can't find out what it is to be human that way any more than you can know what it is to travel on the London Underground by studying a London Underground map. You know, you are not knowing it. That is an entirely different thing. In our culture, there's such a high value placed on independence and autonomy. But if you deny your humanity, if you think that way, because humanity, its purpose is to reflect the person of God. You're dependent on God like a mirror only shows something when it has a separate source of light. Humanity has no meaning, no purpose. You can't explain it without starting with who God is. Secondly, it means that we were designed to love one another and be in community. God is not one person, he's Trinity, Father, Son, and Spirit. And at the very heart of God is love, he's relational. So to be made in the image of God means that we are relational beings, caring for one another. Thirdly, it means that there is dignity and immense value in human life. Your value, or anybody else's value, it can't be determined by considering material things. You're a masterpiece of God's creation. Have a look at these two images. Decide which one you like the best. The one on the left is an original David Thompson. I knocked that up in about 10 minutes this week on my laptop. The one on the right is actually a painting by a guy called Piet Mondrian. And it was painted in 1927 and it goes up for auction next month at Sotheby's. And our auction is expected to raise £18 million. Go figure. Actually, I'm willing to sell mine. I'll perhaps 1 or 2 million. I think it'd be a bargain. Just let me know. What's the difference? Thank you. Do you know, the difference is this. It's not about the material composition. It's about the artist. Every human life is made up of pretty cheap stuff. A bit of carbon, a bit of hydrogen, a bit of oxygen. Do you know you can find all that in a bag of sugar? It's just worthless. But there's something of God in you. And now every life is of incalculable value. So consider any human being that has ever existed. Consider even yourself. Your value, their value, and dignity and worth is not dictated by what they do or how well their brain functions or whether they can exercise autonomy. You don't have to earn your dignity. You have dignity. By virtue of creation, it's about the artist. It's about your creator, the person whose brain has ceased to work because of Alzheimer's, is as valuable as the man or the woman in their 20s. A person in their 30s is no more valuable or less valuable than the unborn child in their mother's womb. And then fourthly, being made in God's image and likeness. What does it mean? It means that it matters how we treat people. Whenever you consider another person, never lose that sense of awe and wonder. Out of everything in creation, every human life is mind-blowingly staggering. Don't lose that sense of wonder. And if you treat people with wonder, you treat them with respect. We're called to treat one another with the same respect and dignity that God gives each of us. We are all equal, of equal value, of equal dignity. So none of us have any right to look down on anyone. And crucially, it means that we are called to exercise protection. Take God out of the equation, and you can make a case that society is made stronger when the strong make use of the weak for their own ends. But Christian thinking turns that on its head. It says every human life carries God's image, so every life is precious. And the strong have a duty to protect the weak. and the vulnerable. So when Jesus saw this woman, he looked beyond her situation and the things that she had done, and he saw a person created in the image of his Father. And that immediately conferred upon her a sense of dignity, a sense of equality with anybody else who was around, and a legitimate need for protection from abuse and mistreatment. So whoever you see, whoever God puts in your path, whoever he puts on your mind, or maybe it's a group of people, and there might be sin and there might be destructive worldly thinking, but don't see the sin, see the person. Don't see the circumstances of a person's life. See the precious life that is behind it. They are of immense value. They are worthy of help. Okay, secondly, Jesus neither condones the sin nor condemns the person. You see, this woman, she had committed adultery. There's no sort of doubt about that. Presumably this had been her lifestyle over a long period of time, because the Pharisees knew where to go and find her so that she could be used as bait for the trap. They were trying to trap Jesus. At no point did Jesus condone her sin. Never once in this story did Jesus say, well, you know, God's law, it's all really just a guideline. Doesn't really matter how you live. You know, adultery, yeah, it's not a great idea, but, you know, it's okay, really. He doesn't say that. That's not his point of view. But equally, once the crowd had melted away, convicted by their own guilt, he says to the woman, neither do I condemn you. So he didn't condone her sin, but he didn't condemn her either. The problem that we have is that when we encounter people who are engaged in sin in some way of their life, they made sinful choices in the past, maybe they're living out the consequences of that sin, the problem is that we feel like we have to choose, that we only have two options. Is it going to be condemn or is it going to be condone? It's like they're two rooms of a house, isn't it? And this house only has two rooms. So if we're not sat down in one room, which might be the room labelled condemn that person, if you're not there, then you must be in the other room. And the other room says condone that sin. And are these the only two options? There's nowhere else to go. You think, if I offer help to that person, then surely I'm just giving approval to their lifestyle and their decisions. I may even be making it easier for them to carry on in sin. I'm condoning what they've done. And you think, well, I don't want to do that, so I better say something. And so leaving the condoning the sin room, you enter the condemning the person room. And you say, I better tell them. I better tell them that what they've been doing is wrong, that God is not happy with them, that they are under God's judgment. And we get in a bit of a muddle, don't we? We need to look at Jesus. Here's what you need to know. Firstly, this, that Jesus will judge all people and all sin. It will all be accounted for. As Christians, we must never get the view that sin is a trivial matter, that God doesn't really mind. That is a massive misunderstanding of grace. Romans 1:18 says, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and the wickedness of men. And we're told throughout the New Testament that Jesus will one day sit as judge over the living and the dead, basically over everyone. So when Jesus said to this woman, neither do I condemn you, don't think for a moment that Jesus had got all soft on sin. He knew that he would sit as judge. So as Ali talks in a moment about the work of options, and we naturally apply this subject of helping those who are struggling as a result of having had an abortion, I'm very aware that even amongst us this morning, there will be a range of people present. You see, there will be a fair number of you who have either experienced an abortion personally, or it's been the experience of someone close to you. You know, over 30% of women in the UK will have an abortion at some point in their lives. And there's no real reason to suggest that that would be lower in the church. If that's you, then do you know what? You need to hear everything this morning, the whole thing. The message for you is to hear about the redemption that is in Jesus. The restoration that is in Jesus. God's heart for you. His heart to forgive and bring a plan to fulfillment in a person's life. So you just need to hang in there. If that's you, hear the whole thing. But I am aware there is also a generation rising up for whom abortion has just been a normal part of society all their lives. And the effect of that is to nullify our senses to the severity of the sin. And we can think, well, abortion is just one of those things that happens and it's just kind of out there. I think there's usually a good reason. No, hang on, there's dignity in life. And there is a responsibility on all of us not to reject the weak and those who cannot help themselves, but to afford them every help and protection. Unborn babies are valuable. Actually, women and men in crisis pregnancy situations are valuable too. All need our care. All need our help. So we could enter into a debate about when life begins. Is it one cell? Is it two cells? Is it implantation or whatever? That really misses the point. The point is there is an intrinsic value on life that outweighs the pressure of circumstances. And yet in England and Wales in 2012, there were 185,122 abortions approved by medical practitioners. Don't just go along with a generation that condones abortion. We need to wake up to the state of our nation. Cry out to God that he would have mercy on us, that a time would come when abortion would be unthinkable in our culture rather than the cultural norm. But as Ali will show you, do you know, it's not necessary to condone abortion in order to show love and care and concern for those who have had an abortion, because do you know what? There is a message of real, genuine hope. So whatever the sin issue relating to a person in need, abortion is just one example I'm using. Obviously, there are a myriad. Don't think that you condone that sin by helping to meet the needs of a person. Secondly, is the Father's desire that all sin is paid for by Jesus? And I want to just let the weight of that sink in. It's the Father's desire that all sin is paid for by Jesus. So Jesus knew that God hates sin and that he himself would one day sit as judge over all sin. Why does he say to the woman, I don't condemn you? Jesus explained his whole ministry, and you can see it earlier in John chapter 3. He's explaining it to a man called Nicodemus. Let me read some words to you. It starts with the familiar words of John 3:16, but we need to read on. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. That's often where we stop, isn't it? But let's carry on. For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe is condemned already because he's not believed in the name of the only Son of God. When it comes to the judgment of God over sin, there are two types of people. There are those who have believed in Jesus, believed that he is God, believed that he died in their place and thereby paid the price for their sin. And whoever believes in Jesus is not condemned. Or as Romans says, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And then that just leaves the other type of people. And that's everyone who has not believed in Jesus. Verse 18 says that they stand condemned already. Not by their actions, by their unbelief. So Jesus didn't come into this world to go from person to person, including this woman caught in adultery, pointing out their sin and saying, I condemn you and I condemn you and I condemn you. He didn't do that. These people stood condemned, not by their actions, by their unbelief, regardless of what they were doing. Jesus came with a message of hope. He said, believe in me
I'm the way to the Father. He said, I've come to seek and save the lost, not condemn them. So thirdly then, don't try to take the place of Jesus in a person's life. If Jesus did not condemn the people he encountered, how much less should we? It's not your place to pass judgment and hand out sentence on a person's sin. If someone is in sin and yet in need, don't think, well, they might be in need, but I need to make them suffer a bit because then they will see the error of their ways. No, that's not how Jesus deals with you. Be like Jesus with this woman. You say, do you know what? I'm in no position to judge you. I just want to help you. And then the third thing Jesus does, he lifts a person out of sin. Jesus sent the woman away with a command. He said, go and from now on sin no more. He had met her immediate need because he'd rescued her from certain death by stoning. And it seems that in doing so, he had also met her wider need of freedom from the sin that had ensnared her life. Now, we don't actually know what this woman went on and did after that, but she'd had an encounter with Jesus, the Son of God. And it gave her a sense of identity, a sense of purpose. It gave her hope. When you come to people showing love and mercy and compassion, you are showing Jesus to people. You are bringing hope. Our one word title for this morning is redemption. It's taken me a while to get around to redemption. But here's the thing. God is our great redeemer. To be redeemed, it means to be released, to be set free, usually by means of payment. And God, in his mercy, releases people from captivity to sin. That payment, that ransom price, was met by Jesus on the cross. So when people encounter Jesus, the effects and the consequences of their sin are rolled back. Lives are restored. I want to show you two passages of the Bible that just show how God is our redeemer. And they're familiar, but remarkably similar. One is Psalm 103. The other is, well, it's Isaiah 61, but Jesus quotes it in the New Testament in Luke chapter 4. So in Psalm 103, it says this, bless the Lord, O my soul, forget not all his benefits. He forgives all your iniquity, heals all your disease. He who redeems your life from the pit, he's your redeemer. Who crowns you with steadfast love and mercy, who satisfies you with good so that your youth is renewed like the eagles. The Lord works righteousness and justice for all who are oppressed. And then just compare that to Luke 4. This is Jesus speaking. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind. To set at liberty those who are oppressed. To proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. Do you see how amazing God's redemption is? It's so much more than forgiveness for sin. Although that in itself is amazing. But it's more than that. He actually lifts people out of the muck and the mire of their sin. He brings hope. He brings restoration. He brings justice. You can be sure that where Jesus is working, people are being lifted out of sin. Situations that seemed broken because of bad decisions, God can bring about the most amazing good. He redeems situations. He redeems lives. So maybe God is speaking to you at the moment. There's a particular person in need or a particular group or section of people. And God's brought them to your attention, and it may be that, you know, this is not clean and tidy, that there are sin issues involved. You feel that sense of awkwardness, you feel uncomfortable, maybe a bit of righteous indignation. But you know what? You can do the work of Jesus in that situation. Being just like that woman caught in adultery. You had that encounter with Jesus. Bring help to these precious people at their point of need. You're not condoning their sin. Neither are you condemning that person. You're simply doing the work of Jesus. But then also know this, whenever Jesus is working, people are always being lifted out of captivity to sin, lifted out of their brokenness, because Jesus is our great Redeemer. And do you know what? This is so key to the work that Options does. So I want Ali to describe this to you. And Ali has been working in this area for what, 15 years? 17 years? 17 years, how old do I feel? And it does a great work, but I'm going to let you describe it. Why don't we welcome Ali, because she doesn't get herself there.
Morning. Morning, morning. We're on. Hello. I'm Ali Thompson. Wow, it's just, I love hearing things like that when we talk about the amazing grace and mercy of God meeting us in our brokenness and doing amazing works in us, and the dignity that that restores to people, because that's really what we're involved in Options. So I've, as David said, I've been working in it for about 17 years. I worked in the Chichester one here, and then before that I worked in the Winchester one. And what I'll do is just give a very brief overview of the whole project for just a couple of minutes, and then focus a bit more on the post-abortion work. So, clicker. Yay. Oh, that's nice. Okay. So, Options. We provide professional support to men and women who are in crisis due to various things. Primarily, our aim is to work with people who are in crisis pregnancy, through whether it's unplanned, unwanted, medically complicated. Sometimes pregnancy becomes a crisis because situations change quite dramatically during the pregnancy. So there's quite a lot of different reasons, and every client is unique, as you can imagine. So that's our primary client group, actually, is looking after people who are in that place. We live in a culture where abortion is seen as a very sensible solution, and often if we have anything less than a perfect pregnancy, if we have anything less than that, we is assumed we would have an abortion because that's the socially, morally responsible path to take. So that puts an enormous pressure on people to be looking at the option of abortion right at the beginning of a pregnancy, when actually, to be fair, what we need to do is really give people time to get used to the idea of being pregnant and then work out what they want to do. So it's a very frightening time for a lot of people. When someone finds out they're pregnant, whatever the circumstances, it's a bit overwhelming. Even when it's planned and wanted and it's great, it's a bit of a shock. But actually, when you multiply that by a very difficult circumstances and perhaps a real lack of support and a lack of care around people, actually it puts them in a very vulnerable position. So our work is really just to come alongside people at that time. We help people to explore their options. We do not put any pressure on them to do one thing or another. We're non-judgmental, non-directive. It's not our life, actually. It's not up to us what people choose to do. People have free will. It's God-given. It's right that we respect that. So we don't have pressure or expectation on them, but we do give them space to engage with their thoughts, their feelings, their situations, really just time to think through what they want to do. And we give them lots of information, and we counsel through that process. We look at the whole story. All of us come with a massive amount of history. We come with our hopes, our dreams, our fears, things we've done great, things we've done badly, things we never thought we would do. Sometimes we find ourselves in places we never thought we'd find ourselves. And actually, when we work with people, we work with the whole person. We work with the whole story. So lots of our clients, people quite often ask us, what's your main client group? Actually, most people are just human. That's our client group. There is no standard client. There is young, there is older, there is married, there is single, there is people at college, there's people in professional jobs, there are people who have had lots and lots of partners, people who've only had one partner, people in a long-term relationship. There's everything, every combination. So we're really there for everybody in our community. We work with families as well, and for partners. So everyone in that situation really needs to be cared for, protected, supported, and resourced. And I think David's covered that really well, so I won't go into that much more. But just to say that we work professionally with our counselling, and that we We really aim just to make them feel that they have the freedom to choose what they really want to choose without the pressure and the panic and the fear. And actually, we really see God working quite amazingly. He really, when he calms down the situation and helps people really engage with what's going on, actually, people have a lot more freedom to really feel the impact of a pregnancy, for good and bad, but actually it helps people just to do this as a whole person and not to just feel that they've got to make an awful decision really quickly. So we often don't know what they choose. Like with this woman who was caught in adultery, Jesus said, here's my grace, here's my loving kindness to you, now go choose good things. But he doesn't know what she chose. And we don't know with most of our clients what they choose to do, but we just work with them for a short time while they're in that place. So that's a brief whistle stop of what we do with that. We also work with people who have stress after an abortion, and I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. And miscarriage. Miscarriage, stillbirth is the other client group that we work with. We, again, live in a culture where it's expected that we control our fertility, and we can a lot, but actually for a lot of people there's also losses that come through trying to have children. We're not very good at handling grief in our culture. I've worked that out. We don't like what it does to us. We don't like what it does to other people. And we get very scared and uncomfortable with that. But actually, for people who've had miscarriages and stillbirths, there is a very natural and right grief process that they go through. And so with options, we just work with people through that. And love to do it. It's, again, a real privilege to be able to work with people in that place. So lastly, I can't go into much detail because I haven't got time, but we also are looking at doing preventative education workshops for teenagers. It is down there. I can't see the word. So we've got some partial funding for that. We're just waiting for some more to come through, and then we're going to do some, obviously preventative work is really great for young people, and also just helping them to realise that we're here if they need our services. So that's something else we're going to be looking at. Okay, so just to focus on the post-abortion support then. Our passion is the person in front of us. And the reason I say that is because people quite often say, oh, where do you sit on the political spectrum of pro-life or pro-choice, or where do you sit on the ethics, or where do you sit on the morality, or where do you sit on this, that and the other? And actually, we just don't. Actually, we deal with the person in front of us. That's our position, if you like. It's a position of grace and a position of mercy. And again, David's covered all that, so you know in that respect why we do what we do. But our main aim is to bring compassion and hope and healing. And really, that's because that's what I would want. You know, I think with the crisis pregnancy work and with the post-abortion work, I put myself in that place and think, what would I need right now? And I give that person what I would need, what I would want. And that's why a lot of what we do is the way we do it. After an abortion, not everyone who has an abortion will have these issues. So some people will go through, and you may know people, or you may be one yourself who had an abortion and actually hasn't really been that rocked by it. So it's not that this happens to everybody, but there are a significant number of people for whom this is a really big issue. And for these clients, we do one-to-one support. So these are the type of things that people will experience afterwards. I think in some ways they're obvious, but just to quickly go through them: sadness, confusion, loneliness, anger, condemnation, guilt, hopelessness, shame, weariness, and fear. They are the most commonly expressed feelings that people come to us with after they've had an abortion. And it may be they had the abortion a few months ago. It may be they had it 20, 30 years ago. So those, we always go through all of them, because actually for most people, that's in there. And if you can imagine, of course, trying to live your life like that is really hard. If you've got children as of your own, as well as dealing with all of that, it makes it very hard. If you are in relationships, if you're trying to work, if you're trying to study, just trying to get through life, when you're carrying all of that with you, it can be really, really devastating. So we just work with people one thing at a time and help them to process what's going on and help them to understand for themselves why that's there. This is regardless of faith. Most of our clients actually are not Christians, because I think actually in the church there's probably quite a good pastoral network for people who are feeling these things. So, but we do have Christian clients as well. But for most of people, they're not Christians, and actually all these things are there. So it's not really a morality issue for them. It's just that actually something really devastating has happened to them, and they're dealing with the effects of it, and they're having to carry that in their lives. So it's confusing for people because abortion is a chosen thing. And as David said, we live in a generation where it's seen as a very ordinary thing and a very clinical, simple, straightforward procedure, a medical solution for an issue. Actually, for a lot of people, it doesn't turn out to be that way. And that's where the confusion can come. People can start to feel that they have done something wrong or that something bad about them, that it's a sign of weakness, that they're going mad. Lots and lots of our clients say, I think I'm just going mad, because when I chose to have this done, it was for all the right reasons and it made sense and everybody around me said it made sense, and yet here I am devastated and I don't know what to do with myself. So again, we just help people to work through what that means. People often feel very ashamed and they judge themselves. Lots of our clients have a very low self-worth by the time they get to us, which again is really sad. Again, it's not something they were expecting to come out of an abortion with, but for lots of them, that's there. Lots of them are very angry at themselves for not being stronger, in inverted commas, feeling that they should have stood up to whatever else was going on at the time and whoever else was sort of encouraging them to do it, even though actually at the time they would have justified it themselves as well. So there's lots of things that start to creep in after an abortion for some people, and it can be a very negative sort of cycle then, because if you're living with those sort of emotions, actually you start to, as I've said, you start to have very negative beliefs about yourself, very damaging beliefs, and your self-worth is going down. Actually, out of that, you start to make more unhelpful choices. Because you don't think you're worth very much, or you think you're an intrinsically unlovable person, or that you can't trust your own decision-making. And wherever you are in your life, actually, once you start to believe those things, you do start to then act out of that, which actually in themselves will then cause more negative consequences in your life. And then you reinforce that cycle of I'm rubbish and everything I do is rubbish. So it is a very lonely and frightening place to live, and lots of our clients express those similar sort of experiences. So we work with people through that. So this is in a nutshell, this is the kind of process we take people through. It's a bereavement process. Lots of people find that quite surprising, that people who've had an abortion will then need to go through a bereavement. And of course, it's counterintuitive, isn't it? You think, well, if you've chosen that, why do you need to grieve it? And FYI, you chose it. So it's a very strange position that people find themselves in, that they need to grieve something that they have chosen to lose. And yet, we're not there to judge one way or the other on this. We're just there to say, look, you've lost something really important to you. It's obviously had an impact on you. Let's work through those losses. And it's up to the client then to identify what those losses are. We don't ever put that on people because we're not there to make them see things a certain way. We're there to let them go through their own journey. But we basically, what they do is they will understand in their own way, obviously there's a baby that's not been born. They have hopes. I mean, very few people in their life will grow up thinking one day I'm going to have an abortion. It's not something we put on our list of things to do. And so actually there's a massive adjustment that goes on there for people as they have to accommodate that that's a part of who they are now. So they grieve their hopes. Relationships can struggle a lot from this. Their reputation, because if other people are aware of it, they feel that damages their reputation. Their future, because it does sometimes mean that maybe people make different choices for their future than they were going to make. Self-worth, I've talked about, family expectations. If it's a teenager and they've had an abortion because they feel they would have disappointed their parents otherwise, well, that puts a huge amount of pressure on their family relationships and the family expectations on them. So there's a lot of different things, and every client will bring their own material into that and they have their own journey. And what we do is we carefully and sensitively facilitate that process, and we have a sort of structured program that we work through. We never force clients to say anything. They say what they want. Their journey is their own, and we just really make them feel safe enough to acknowledge it and to be brave enough to face the reality of what's happened for them. The options counsellors work with clients for all these issues. Forgiveness is a really amazing one. So once they've acknowledged and understood and accepted the past, we then, which again is several months' work, it's not a quick thing, come to a place of forgiveness. And that's amazing. And I think this is my single most amazingly favouritest unit on the whole course. Because whoever anybody is, whether they've faith or no faith, whether they've had a great family upbringing or a rubbish one, everybody gets to the forgiveness bits and things change. And it's so exciting. Some people have never really kind of thought about forgiveness before. Some people have not experienced it in their families or in their marriages or their relationships. Others know forgiveness really well. But what we do is we just help people to understand the value and the power of the principle of forgiving and being forgiven. And for lots of clients, of course, the first and main person they forgive is themselves. And that's amazing. Amazing. If you live with this awful sense of judging yourself and condemning yourself and considering yourself unworthy of your own esteem, then actually you trash yourself for every day of your life. But if you come to a place of forgiving and being forgiven, it's an amazing release. So for clients who haven't got a faith, it's a very much focused on themselves. It's on focusing on the relationships around them. And for those who are Christians, of course, it actually goes into the full redemptive forgiveness of really meeting with God in this. Absolutely and wonderfully amazing. It's my favourite bit. And then in terms of restoring dignity and value and identity. And again, I think David actually covered that really well, like Jesus did with that woman caught in adultery. Really, our whole goal is to help people understand again, and maybe for the first time, that they are so beautiful and so valuable. We are not the sum total of what we choose to do. We're just not. And I praise God for that. I give thanks for him for that in my own life. And I see it in my clients. And most of my clients, we don't ever really talk about God, but we're talking about this principle that you are valuable, not because of what you choose to do, but because you are human and that gives you value. And you have the right to enjoy your life, but there are certain things we have to deal with in order to do that. Just want to finish with a couple of testimonies. Because I think the clients always speak the loudest, don't they? And they have the most amazing voice. So this is a post-abortion client. She says, "I would like to thank you very much for all the help and support you've given me through counselling. It's a wonderful thing you do because it gives people like me the chance to enjoy life again. I wouldn't be where I am now if it wasn't for your help. I thank you from the bottom of my heart." I love this girl's feedback. She wasn't one of my clients. She was one of the team. But I love when she says people like me, because that's how people see themselves when they've had abortions. They consider themselves sort of a subsection. They consider themselves, not quite the same as everyone else because they've done something awful and they've come into a place they never thought they would. And they sort of set themselves apart as not quite worthy. And my heart goes out to them because actually I think it's not true, but actually the work we do is helping that to change. But I love that she sees now things are different. I love that she can see that she engaged really well with the forgiving section particularly, actually. And one of the things that I think is also really powerful about this girl is that she's actually a teenager. And it just broke my heart to think of a teenager entering adulthood carrying that kind of devastation. I just think it's not right. It's just not right for anyone to be that broken before they've even grown up. So I love the work I do. It's amazing. So she's in a good place. So the last one just to talk about is actually a Christian client that came to us. Again, a beautiful testimony. So that it, as in the counselling, has set me free from the guilt and shame that I have been carrying for many years. I think the course is fantastic. It's hard, it's challenging, but amazingly releasing. It covered everything and more. The step that helped me the most was grief, being able to remember the child. I had no idea how I would feel at the end of this course. I'd struggled to believe that I could be set free and to feel peace all about my baby. But by the grace of God, I've worked through things I had no idea were there, and now I can truly say that I am free. And again, I just love that one. And I think it is amazing because a lot of us can spend years and years and years and years and years in a really good church and really knowing that we're forgiven, but actually to really be impacted and fully saturated in the amazing redeeming forgiveness of God is kind of different. And so that's I just wanted to encourage, if anybody's in that situation and thinks, yeah, I know I'm forgiven, it's fine, it's sorted, I covered it in my freedom in Christ, it's all over, I'm good. If actually you feel there's a but on the end of that, because actually maybe it's not all quite right, please come and see me, because there is so much more and there is hope and healing no matter what. Sorry for nearly last slide. Okay, just in terms of what we need, because that's obviously what we do. So what we need is prayer support. If you are at all moved by anything I'm saying, or just think, yeah, do you know what? I could pray once a week for you guys, or I could get your prayer newsletter and I could pray for you. Or if you have prayer groups or maybe in your life groups, anything, any prayer would be amazing, because we love to be prayed for. Because obviously that's what keeps the work going. Financial support, we're, as a lot of charities are, absolutely on our knees financially. So we cost about £12,000 a year to run. So if you, even £10 a month makes such a big difference to what we do and how we can do it and how we can plan. So that would be great. Fundraisers, if you're going to do a parachute jump, or if you're going to do anything crazy, you're going to run a marathon or anything nuts like that, make sure you get sponsored. And if you want to get sponsored for us, that would be great. Or if you've got anything else going on, or any fundraising ideas, or if you love filling in applications for grants, come and see me, because you will be my dream at the moment I do it, and it's not a pretty picture. Education workers, obviously, if we're looking to get the education team up and running, so if that's your heart, come and let me know. And counsellors, finally, but quite importantly, if you want to train as a counsellor, come and let me know. So, Amy, where's Amy Rogers? Hello, Amy's at the back. Can you wave again, Amy? Thank you. Amy's our go-to girl this morning, because I've got to shoot off to Bognor with David. So at the end of the meeting, if you want to ask any questions or see... Oh, okay, we're doing that like that. Yep, that's fine. If you want to make any donations or pick up leaflets and cards, it's all going to be in the foyer, and Amy is the person to talk to. And then just, I'll leave those details up there. If there's anything else you want, just phone me, text me, come and see me, drop in onto the centre, but phone me before you come. That'd be great. Thank you. Thank you.
Good stuff. Wonderful. So what an excellent example of God's redemptive heart to all of us as well. And